I'm going to call this meeting of the House Community and Regional Affairs Committee. It is Thursday, April 14th, and the time is 8:06 a.m. We have present Representative Prox, Representative McCarty, Co-Chair Shragi, and myself, Representative Hannon. Representative Pakatuk and Representative McCabe have been previously excused to be absent, and we know that Representative Drummond is going to join us late because she had a 7:30 meeting. This morning. I'd like to thank our House Records Secretary Shannon McCain and then our LIO moderator Kelsey Riker for assisting the committee this morning. I'd like to remind everyone in the room to please silence your cell phones. And first up today, we will return to House Bill 349 and hear invited and public testimony. And I'll invite up to the table Representative Rauscher's staff, Representative Ryan McKee. Representative Rauscher is to be calling and joining us from Ukviagvik. So we'll plug him in when he gets here. But Mr. McKee is joining us, and we'll have him make some, just put himself on the record, and then we have invited testimony this morning.
All right. For the record, Ryan McKee, staff to Representative George Rauscher, and then on the line, Jeremy Price with AOGCC will be going over some slides, some handouts that you guys should have.
Okay.
And then we also have a representative from Ledge Legal on the line in case you have some more questions on language. And then Graham Smith with DNR.
Yes. And so I'm going to turn first then to AOGCC. And Mr. Price, in addition to the slides that you provide in us, which I don't, you're using the term slides generically, are they, they're just handouts. So we're really looking for an explanation of the process issue that we're changing in the public process in Section 2. But let's go ahead and get started.
Thank you, Madam Co-Chair, members of the committee. I will give my statement and provide some information on what the bill does and why the bill is needed. And then we also have on the line our engineering commissioner, Jesse Chmielowski, and she was going to talk through some of those slides that are real-world examples of spacing exceptions. The purpose of this legislation is to reduce administrative barriers. The AOGCC is tasked under AS31.05.100 A and B, withholding hearings for any changes to oil and gas pool unit designations, rules, or spacing patterns, even where all relevant properties within a given pool belong to a single owner. This requirement for hearings in every instance causes unnecessary delay to pool owners and generates unnecessary costs for the state, as the AOGCC must engage in the protracted process of issuing notice and holding hearings before taking action. HB 349 would update the process, reduce unnecessary delays to pool owners, and save the state time and money that would otherwise be spent on superfluous notice and hearing requirements. More specifically, Section 1 of HB 349 amends AS31.05.100A to remove the requirement that the AOGCC must hold a hearing prior to establishing a drilling unit or units for each pool. Or to put it more plainly, under the existing statute, where an explorer discovers oil or gas, the statute requires the AOGCC to hold a hearing on the spacing of wells that will be drilled within the same pool and establish a drilling unit or units for that pool. The default drilling unit size is the governmental section for gas and the governmental quarter section for oil. Section 1 of the bill removes the requirement to hold a hearing and the requirement to establish a drilling unit. Why is this necessary? The concept of establishing drilling units that are essentially boxes on a map where only one vertical well can be drilled within that box is completely outdated with horizontal drilling. Section 2 amends AS31.05100E to make it discretionary rather than mandatory for the AOGCC to issue notice and hold a hearing in each instance where an exception is granted to the rules or spacing patterns prescribed to a particular pool. Within this change, AOGCC could allow the operator to drill additional wells within the same pool without having to go through 30 days of notice and comment followed by the issuance of a conservation order. From 2016 to 2020, prior to the pandemic, AOGCC publicly noticed 47 hearings on non-controversial well spacing exceptions that no member of the public requested nor submitted testimony. How this statutory change might impact the AOGCC regulations can be seen on page one of our materials. As you can see on page one, the portion of the regulation that is crossed out would be deleted from the regulations if this bill were to pass. In that regulation, which is 28AC25.055A, the creation of drilling units would no longer be required. In 28AC25.055A3 and 4, the default drilling unit size of governmental section and quarter section would be repealed, and the spacing restriction between wells producing from the same pool would also be repealed. However, as you can see in paragraphs 1 and 2, the spacing restriction of wells drilled close to property lines would remain to protect the correlative rights of owners of the resource. Or in other words, 1 and 2 must remain to protect against draining of the resource from adjacent owners. From here, I'm going to hand off to Commissioner Jesse Chmielewski to talk through these other handouts.
Thank you. Just before I want to just know members are seeking my attention. So, Ms. Chmielewski.
Good morning, Chair Hannum. Oh, good morning, Chair Hannum. Just want to double check you can hear me.
Perfect. Go ahead.
Thank you. This is Jesse Chmielewski. I'm the Engineering Commissioner of the Alaska Oil and Gas Conservation Commission. I'd first like to thank you for your consideration of this bill. It proposes to modify a statute that has not been changed since it was first adopted in 1955. And I'd like to say at the beginning that if approved, this bill would not impact the AOGCC's ability to fulfill its mission. It's an important update that would allow us to be more efficient. The title of the bill refers to drilling units, but the proposed language edits really have to do with inter-well spacing exceptions, or how far one well must be from another in the subsurface. And not just anywhere below the surface, but in the targeted productive reservoir. In the 1950s, when the statute was written, it was common for oil and gas wells to be developed, oil and gas fields to be developed with vertical wells, and at times, operators would drill wells too close together, resulting in waste or reduction in the amount of hydrocarbons that can be recovered. Now, I believe you have seen the photo of Spindletop. I'm not sure if you have it now. But that was, you know, an example of the first-come, first-served approach. And there were no controls on the development then, and so too many wells were drilled too close together. As a result, the reservoir pressure dropped rapidly, resulting in stranded reserves or waste. So after the Conservation Act of the 1930s, agencies like the AOGCC were formed in states all over the country to prevent the waste of hydrocarbon resources. And one way to prevent waste was to set default drilling units. In Alaska, the default drilling units are one governmental section for gas wells and one governmental quarter section for oil wells. I'll talk a little bit about that when we go to the map. Only one well is allowed to per default drilling unit unless the AOGCC grants a spacing exception, which requires a hearing. So again, the purpose of establishing default drilling units and requiring the AOGCC to hold hearings for spacing exceptions was to prevent waste of the resource, or alternatively, to encourage greater ultimate recovery of the resource. And that's part of the AOGCC's mission. Now I'll talk about why allowing wells to be drilled closer than the default spacing encourages greater ultimate recovery. Today, with modern technology, wells are drilled based on geology and reservoir characteristics. Default drilling units based on governmental sections are out of date. It is common for wells to be planned and drilled closer than the default spacing. An interesting tidbit about Prudhoe Bay is that when it started up 44 years ago, the estimated recoverable reserves were about 9 billion barrels of oil. Now today, with advancements in drilling and reservoir management, the estimated recoverable reserves are about 14 billion barrels of oil. The point being that updating to current best practices is to the benefit of Alaska. I'll talk through now a couple of recent examples. And so for the papers in front of you, I'd like to please refer to pages 2 and 3. three, and those are my example number one, Blue Crest Energy. So I think, I'm not sure if they're on the same page or not, but you could look at pages two and three, and I'm going to start on page three. So this is, again, Blue Crest Energy, and Blue Crest is an operator in the Cook Inlet area. As you're looking at the picture on page three, you'll see the wells originate from a pad that's onshore, and they extend below the subsurface to the offshore gas field, oil and gas field. Now, you can't see very well on this picture on page three, but you can see that there's some text that talks about sections, section 27, section 26, section 4. Those are supposed to show sort of this grid pattern that's the governmental section. It's just a square grid. And you'll see that as these wells extend offshore, that out in the reservoir area, there are multiple dots, and there's a whole bunch of text that's hard to read. Now, that relates to the locations of what they call fishbone laterals. And so you'll see how many there are, and you'll see how many there are per section on that map. So now we'll switch to page number two. And on page number two is a colorful drawing that illustrates the side view of one of the wells drilled in the Cosmopolitan unit. Now, the well starts, as you can imagine, off the page on the right, and the motherboard continues across the page to the left, to that farthest left point that kind of extends upward. That's the motherboard. And while developing the field, they would then pull the drill string back and drill these multiple laterals that go up, up into the gas and oil zone to cross the entire reservoir. You can see sort of from top to bottom. So the spacing between those fishbone laterals is about 800 feet. So that would result in the need for seven or more spacing exceptions per fishbone under the existing statute. Because every lateral, every penetration is measured the distance from the next one. But this, Blue Crest has tried multiple ways to develop this field and found this to be the best way to recover the most reserves. And it is an administrative burden for them and for the AOGCC to issue and hold notice spacing exception hearing for every single fishbone lateral. Just wondered if there are any questions about Blue Crest.
I don't see anyone else, so I'm going to take the opportunity, Ms. Chmielowski. So in that example, with those seven spacing exceptions, would that require one hearing, or is that seven separate hearings? So we heard from Mr. Price a description that between 2016 and 2020, there were 47 hearings. So I'm just trying to figure out, in a hearing, is it seven spacing exceptions, or each one of those counts as a hearing?
Each one counts as a hearing because each one's considered a separate well bore. So that would be seven hearings for one single well.
Okay. And well. So one more. Would those seven hearings happen simultaneously, or are they having to require separate public notice, separate date and time?
They're all separate.
So would you have seven and notice to have seven in one day, or notice to have them on seven separate days? And I'm trying to understand the administrative task requirement for that. Now that we've decided
right.
It's, we're going to do it, what it looked like.
Right, right. So each one would require notice in the newspaper and notice out to, 30 days notice out to the public and then a time on this calendar. I suppose, if Blue Crest had all of these plans ahead of time, you could potentially schedule them all for one day. My understanding is, and these were drilled, some of them before I started at the AOGCC, that they sometimes don't know all the laterals they're going to drill until they drill some of them. So it kind of piecemeals itself in little increments. So it's usually multiple days, multiple hearings, multiple notices.
Okay. And one more. Is it correct to assume that the older a field is, the more need for additional spacing exceptions, that the likelihood of reducing the spacing between drillings, because we're trying to find that last drop, right? So is that correct?
Yeah. So when the operator first drills, like you would say, like you expect, they're going to drill farther apart. But then it's the development drilling, where they end up wanting to fine tune those well locations, and they decide that based on geology, not based on that square grid.
Right. And what I'm, because, so we've talked about what it's looked like 2016 to 2017, 47 hearings, no one testified. My presumption is, and we're looking primarily at Cook Inlet, that's my recollection from when I met with you, that's the example you're showing us, that we're going to see, you're going to see a lot of requests for them for the exceptions to well spacing in that field over the next decade, because we've talked about it being purchased, you know, by a company who specifically sort of targets declining fields and modernizing, and so I assume we're going to see a lot of drill spacing. So I just want to, we're not shortening or changing the public requirement, but you're probably going to have a lot of those well spacing exceptions being okay as that field and Hillcore works Cook Inlet.
Yes. I'd say that generally, I don't think the AOGCC has ever denied an interwell spacing exception. We go through the process, but I'd say overall, the interests of the operator and the state of Alaska are aligned, and both parties want to recover the most possible. And the Cook Inlet is the primary area that would benefit from this legislation because the fields on the North Slope, you know, are much larger. And, you know, it's such an expensive location. They have to have what I might call critical mass. And so as I go to my second example, you'll see that they plan those entire fields before they drill a single well because they have to know if they can make money up there before they do anything. Whereas in the Cook Inlet, it's smaller targets. And so it's usually kind of planned as they go, see how things are, you know, producing.
Okay. One more thing, because you said it really quickly, so I want to just repeat it on the record, that your recollection is that AOGCC has never turned down, even after public notice and participation in well spacings, that they've been approved.
For interwell spacing.
Yes.
That's my understanding, because they're all carefully reviewed.
Right.
But there's really never an instance where an operator that we could tell is making a really bad decision about where to place his well. It costs them a lot of money, so they're pretty careful about it.
Okay. Great. Go ahead and continue.
Oh, thank you. So if you could now switch to pages 4 and 5, and this is my example number 2 for ConocoPhillips. We'll start on page 4. And if you look at this is a bird's eye view of the planned development of the Rendezvous oil pool in the Greater Moose Tooth Unit. So what you look at there is you can see, first of all, that grid pattern of the section, such as like a grid overlay onto the land. And then you'll see kind of that curving purple line, which delineates what they think is the Rendezvous oil pool in the subsurface, sort of the outer boundary of the oil pool. And then you're going to look at those. To me, they look orange, but there's a bunch of diagonal lines all kind of together, sort of at the middle bottom part of that page. And now those are the planned wells that they're going to drill. And you'll notice that every well crosses multiple sections. So each of these wells would require a spacing exception and notice of hearing under the existing statute. And I just like, because it's interesting, I'd like to mention that, you know, why are these wells in this diagonal direction, right? Why do they take that direction? And that's just another example of operators using the reservoir characteristics to plan the well. What they have determined from their exploration drilling is that, you know, when the rock is laid down, it can have different porosities, different permeabilities, and sometimes oil and gas will move through the reservoir more favorably in one direction than another. So they've laid out the wells in the way they think the oil will move most favorably from the injector to the producer. So in this proposed horizontal well development, so you'll see, I think there's an orange dot. It says MC7. That's the drill pad. And then they're going to drill all of these horizontals from that pad. And this yields greater recovery than a you know, conventional vertical well development plan with one well per section. If you go to slide 5, really just a zoomed in view of those wells specifically. And I'll just point out that what they're doing is doing alternating injectors and producers. And so they've had good success with that, where the injectors, you know, basically push the oil along the length of the lateral towards those producers, and they recover much more oil that way. So again, each of these wells would require an interwell spacing exception under the existing statute, but it is the best way to develop the field. So that's just another example of the administrative burden to do all these notices of hearing. I'll just pause in case there are any questions about the second example.
Not right now at the end. No, go ahead.
Okay, thank you. I'm getting close to them, and I just would like to say that, you know, in summary, the technical review of building permits by AOGCC engineers and geologists is robust, and it would not change. With the passage of this bill, the AOGCC will continue to fulfill its mission to prevent the waste of Alaska's valuable hydrocarbon resources. And I'd like to thank you again for your consideration, but if you'll permit me, there are a couple of topics from the session on Tuesday that I'd like to address more fully, if that's okay with you, Chair Hannon?
Yep. Yes, go ahead.
Okay. The first thing I wanted to mention is just a brief discussion on space, a different type of spacing exception near a lease boundary where the ownership is not the same on both sides. So the proposed bill that we're talking about today would only affect the requirement to notice hearing for inter-well spacing exceptions. But there is another type of spacing exception that the AOGCC oversees. And this is something that I mentioned to several of you when we met in person. The second type of spacing exception deals with lease boundaries and how close the well can be drilled to a boundary where the ownership is not the same on both sides. The AOGCC has strict rules on this and requires a minimum standoff from boundaries where the ownership is not the same. Specifically, we require a minimum distance of 1,500 feet for an oil well and 3,000 feet for a gas well. And the purpose of this is to protect correlative rights, which are the rights of an owner of the resource to recover his or her share of that resource. So the spacing exception requirement to protect correlative rights is not affected by the proposed bill and would be unchanged. The AOGCC would still be required to notice hearings for any spacing exceptions of that type. So then I had a second question I wanted to address from Tuesday, and the question had to do with, would a spacing exception have prevented the gas leak on the Alpine CD1 drill site? So no, it would not have prevented the gas leak. As I mentioned earlier, interwell spacing exceptions, like the ones we're discussing in the proposed bill, address how far one well must be from another in the subsurface. But not just anywhere below the surface, in the targeted productive reservoir. All the wells on the CD1 drill site target deeper reservoir zones than the one that started leaking last month. Specifically at CD1, a well was being drilled that targeted a deep reservoir zone. And on its way, it drilled through a sand known as halo. And many wells have drilled through the halo sand with no issues, and it was not considered a productive hydrocarbon zone. And since it was not considered a productive hydrocarbon zone, cement was not placed across it during that stage of the well completion. So in this case, the halo sand was productive and started producing gas. The gas migrated up the well and into the saw bulb. What we call a saw bulb is an area directly below the drill site where heat from production and injection wells has thawed out an area of the permafrost. So once the gas migrated into this thawed area, it came to surface at various locations via the path of least resistance. The source of the gas has been identified and is in the process of being cemented and isolated. Getting back to spacing exceptions, the CD1 well would not have required a spacing exception as no nearby wells target or produced from the halo sand. So, Chair Hannon, that concludes my testimony. I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Great. Thank you. And I appreciate you returning to our questions and giving us information. Answering. Representative Schrage.
Thank you, Co-Chair Hannon. So just for clarity in follow-up to the conversation from the last committee hearing on this bill, so this isn't just exclusive to Cook Inlet. This does include other production zones, like on the North Slope, but it's primarily causing an issue in Cook Inlet. Is that correct?
Yes. Oh, Chair Schrage, I'm sorry, I didn't realize you were there. Yes, you're absolutely correct. It would affect wells statewide. Now, as I mentioned, the fields on the North Slope tend to have a larger critical mass. And so to get a little more into the, you know, specifics is that the AOGCC does sometimes issue conservation orders for what we call pool rules. And the pool rules are guidelines for how to best manage the reservoir. Now, sometimes AOGCC, and this also requires notice and hearing, issue pool rules for the exclusive purpose of getting rid of the requirement for these inner well spacing exceptions. That is like the sole purpose of most of our pool rule applications. And so operators on the North Slope, like if they have critical mass, they know for sure where they're going to drill their wells, as I showed you on that rendezvous example. So they can plan ahead and know they're going to need X number of exceptions and apply for pool rules that waive that requirement. Whereas in the Cook Inlet, they have the same issue, but they just tend to have smaller developments. They don't know what they're going to do ahead of time sometimes. Thank you.
Thank you. Follow up for me. So on a slightly different topic, another question. So you talked about the public notice for drilling near the border when the owner on the adjacent unit is not the same. So I'm looking at 25.055 in the page one of this handout that outlines all of the changed text. And so we have you know, section A, subsection 1 and 2, which talks about oil and gas drilling next to a property line where the owner is the same on both sides. So you're saying that there is a separate section entirely from what is being changed here that pertains to public notice for when the owners are not the same. So that's found in a different section of statute. Is that correct?
That's correct. Yes. What you're reading in that, you know, it clearly states the owner is the same and the landowner is the same on both sides. If it's not the same on both sides, and I support this, the AOGCC will notice and require a notice of a hearing and to protect the correlative rights. That will not change, and I would never want that to change.
Thank you. And another follow-up, if I may, on a different topic, bouncing around here. So, you know, part of the reason that has been outlined for this change being warranted is that the technology has changed in how we recover the oil in such a way that this really just isn't an issue anymore. I guess, is there any, I'm not an expert in this industry by any means, and so forgive me if this is an unintelligent question, but is there any chance that, you know, some scrappy producer would come in and try to, you know, salvage a field or for some reason unknown to me, use the older technology or try to recover oil or gas in the old way where this would again be an issue? Or is that technology and method just completely abandoned and there's really no chance that someone would utilize that prior method where you're drilling many vertical wells into the reservoir?
Through the chair, you know, it's very unlikely, but it's, you know, anything is possible, right? That's what we know in life. Anything is possible. It's certainly possible, and that's where I emphasize that we have the option always to notice a hearing at any time. So if the AOGCC geologists and engineers, if we recognize something that didn't look right, it was unusual in any way, we would reserve that right to hold a hearing and deny that permit until we understood fully what they were doing.
Follow up, if I may, this time on the same question.
so you
said you reserved the ability to do public notice should that situation come up where someone tries to use one of those older methods and public notice would be warranted in that case. But with subsection 3 and 4 being completely struck out from statute, would you still have that authority and be able to require that public notice for that to be established, or would you not?
Through the chair, absolutely we would. And if you go to the statute language, what we're doing is changing the word, you know, shall, which is a requirement, to the word may. And then just, you know, for in general, the AOGCC can call a hearing on any topic at any time. We don't need to have it written down specifically. And we do sometimes of our own accord require a hearing on a topic. And it could be it could be something that's not, you know, explicitly written in our regulations and statutes. It could be a question about how an operator wants to complete a well, and we have concerns about it, and so we want to get it on the public record. And so we will always have that right, and we really value having information on the public record if anything is unusual, so that it's documented.
Co-Chair Shragi, can I also add a quick comment to that response, to the question?
Yes, go ahead. Mr. Price.
This is Jeremy Price of the AOGCC. In addition to what Commissioner Chmielowski said, in the statute, AS31.05.060, any member of the public can request a hearing. They can petition the AOGCC, can ask for a hearing on any issue within our jurisdiction. So that the rights of the public are preserved with this change. And to be able to just be frank, a hearing on spacing exceptions is very, very technical. It would require a great deal of education expertise to even be able to comment on a specific spacing exception issue. Anytime that an issue has been raised at a public hearing that we were holding on the spacing exception has been regarding issues that are completely unrelated to the issue at hand that we can't even consider. For instance, the complaints about noise. That's an issue that's not under AOGCC jurisdiction. We can't do anything about it. It's completely irrelevant to the hearing. So I hope that sheds a little light on the preservation of the public participation. And of course, DNR is on the line because they have a very robust process and multiple opportunities for public comment long before the issue comes before the AOGCC.
Thank you. Okay. I guess I want to just clarify because we've used the words statute and regulation, and we have not been referring, but the handout you sent to us is as part of the packet today with the deleted subsections 3 and 4 is actually regulation, correct?
Correct. And that would reflect the change of the law, if the bill were passed into law.
Okay, but one step out, because statute doesn't automatically change regulations, so there'll also be a process for those regulations to change, correct?
Correct. This is just a proposal of what it might look like. You would, of course, go through the public process.
Okay, so... and in that process, you are required it. So the process could change this deletion, or is that entirely within your control that these are the words that are deleted?
We would never presume to, before engaging in the public process, say anything definitively. We would have to go through that process, hear what the public has to say before we could. That would be premature for me to say. This is just what the language might look like.
Okay, but we've been talking about it as if when we pass the bill, this is the language change, and I just want to make sure we understand that's not an absolute. I also want to make sure we have, because we've been talking about correlative rights in that separate section of regulation, could you give us that citation for the regulation of that, so if we wanted to look at it?
I'm sorry, Madam Chair, the citation for which section?
That covers correlative rights if you were different landowners on the boundary?
Yeah. Just a moment.
And I'll take the moment to say that Representative Jumman joined us at 8:36 a.m. Her second meeting of the day. Ms. Price, we'll let you find that and come back to it. But just because we're talking about regulation, when really all we have the authority to do is change statute, and we want to make sure that we have understood them in relation to the statute we're changing.
Understood, Madam Co-Chair. And I'll provide that if we happen to close the hearing. Be sure to provide the committee before close of business today.
Okay. Any other questions for AOGCC while we've got them? All right. So now we're going to switch to DNR. Mr. Smith from DNR. And I guess to give you the question, and in case this says you're there for questions as opposed to a specific presentation. So could you describe for us the public notice requirements that exist currently for DNR in these changes and would continue to exist? And then we'll probably also want you to address any concerns or thoughts that DNR has on well spacing change variations, but I, you know, most of that goes to AOGCC. So the public process.
Yes. Good morning, Co-Chair Hannon. For the record, my name is Graham Smith. I'm a petroleum land manager for the Division of Oil and Gas within DNR, Department of Natural Resources. So thank you for having me. First of all, the constitutional obligation under Article 8, Section 10 says that no disposals of state interest shall be made without public notice. So at the very beginning of our process, before we hold the lease sale, we have a robust process at that time. And those are best interest findings, written decisions by the director. And those are before we even begin the leasing process. And then after that, we have, of course, the public notice requirements that are in 3805 and Title 38 that are fairly prescriptive about how we conduct a public notice. But on top of that, each phase of the development has its own public notice. So we have the leasing, where we have disposal phase, we have the exploration phase, where they'll go out and drill wells. We have the development phase, production phase, transportation, termination. Each one of those phases has its own public notice. And then within those opportunities for the public to weigh in, we also have any additional disposals of interest that might happen. For example, if an operator wants to expand a pad to drill more wells and they're going to add acreage, that's a new disposal. So that would also require a public notice. Any easements out there that might be for pipelines that extend outside of a leasehold or a unit, that's another disposal of interest and will require another public notice. And then on top of that, we have the, like I mentioned, the unitization part of it. It would be sort of the development phase of it that has a public notice requirement. And then there was the 2013 court decision. It was Sullivan versus Red Oil, and that's the resistance. I always forget this one. Resistance of Environmental Destruction of Indigenous Lands Group. That was a litigation that resulted in the court determining that each one of these phases does need to have its own assessment of cumulative impacts associated with it. And that is where we come up with our phase decision making, which means that each time a operator moves from the exploration phase or any of the other phases throughout the life cycle of an oil and gas development, we go out to the public for a 30-day public notice and solicit for feedback and comments. And I'll pause here. That's a lot. We do quite a few public notices here. So I could elaborate on any one of those opportunities, but I'll pause here for the moment.
I am not seeing any questions, so go ahead and proceed.
Okay, and I appreciate the opportunity to explain it because we do feel like we do quite a few public notices, but I'll kind of summarize by saying that any new disposal of interest is going to require one. Anything that we decide might be of public interest, much like the AOGCC, even if there isn't a statutory regulatory obligation to conduct a public notice, we often will. For example, for seismic exploration projects, those aren't technically disposals of interest. Those are fully revocable temporary land use permits. But due to the magnitude sometimes of the projects, due to the proximity to North Slope communities or just general public interest, because lately those projects have been attracting quite a bit of interest, we will do a public notice for those as a discretionary matter, but we do almost every time for a seismic exploration project a full public process. And with that, I think I've hit the main points of our public notice. Of course, there are other ones that tend to get sprinkled in there based on what we think might be in the public's interest, but those are the main benchmarks there for our that trigger a public process through DNR.
Okay. Representative McKay has a question.
Thank you, the Chair. This is Rep. McCarty.
Representative McCarty. Sorry, looking right at him.
Coffee's still working on me, too. So, Mr. Smith, the comment of public notice is currently that the AOGCC has its public notice and DNR has its public notice to accomplish the same purpose. So it has to go through two public notice process, or am I incorrect in thinking that?
Yeah, Rep McCarty through the chair. It's a good question. We do work closely with AOGCC at points of overlap, but in this case, we're really talking more about the land owner responsibilities, and a lot of times that revolves around the surface estate. Obviously, we've got a lot of subsurface interest in the Division of Oil and Gas, but in my section, I'm the permitting section chief for the division. We're mostly interested in soliciting opinion from the public on the surface uses, and AOGCC a lot of times is more focused on the subsurface, specifically, you know, the wellhead and the well bores. And so there is some overlap here or there, but for the most part, we're soliciting for a different kind of feedback on the fundamentals of the project, and there's not actually as much overlap as it might sound.
Follow up.
So the proposal of this bill would expedite the process with no apparent harm to ignoring the public notice in the process?
Yeah, Rep. McCarty through the chair. I wouldn't speak necessarily for AOGC's process, but I can tell you that it wouldn't have any impact on ours. And I would say that this bill makes a lot of sense to me. We also have the same view of advances in technology, new sort of prudent operator sort of standards based on that mean that a lot of these things can be more onerous in nature than proportional to the value that they provide to the public. And I think that in this case, it makes a lot of sense what they're proposing.
Okay, thank you.
Mr. Smith, does DNR have an official position on the bill?
Co-Chair Hannon, I'm not familiar of us formulating an official position on it, but I can check with my leadership to make sure that I am just not unaware of such a position, but I'd be happy to respond back to the committee on that.
Okay, and I'm going to ask AOGC see the same thing. We have this presumption because they're advocating for it and it's quote their bill, but we actually don't have on the public record much, and so I'm just trying to make sure that we've included that this isn't just a wild idea of a legislator, or that there are experts and agencies are advocating for a change. We didn't come up with this on our own. We're not that smart. Anyone else? Otherwise, I'm going to, we also do have Emily Nauman from Ledge Legal Online, who's the drafter. Did you have a question for her, Representative?
Yes,
Cardin?
Thank you. Through the chair, I do have a question. I understand, who's online?
Emily Nauman.
Okay, I understand, Emily Nauman, that, of the may and shall in the language, but can you explain why there was a change in the that and which?
For the record, this is Emily Nauman, Legislative Legal Services. The statutes that are being amended in this bill, both of them, both 100A and 100B, have not been amended in quite some time. So we took the opportunity to, on page 1, line 6, and the remainder of what shows up on page 2, to update the statutory language. I believe it's been over 30 years since these statutes have been amended, and so we are just modernizing the language in accordance with our drafting manual.
Follow up. So can you explain the definition of why that is preferred over which?
For the record, again, this is Emily Nauman, Legislative Legal Services. Gosh, no, we have a legal editor that can dive way deep into the grammar on this, but I do know that is actually the correct word to use there as opposed to which.
Okay, thank you.
Okay, we were waiting to be schooled on grammar.
That comes from the Society of English Majors.
Well, it's the society for laws are supposed to be understood by other lawyers, so we're again defer to the experts on this. Is there anyone else? All right. Then I'm going to open public testimony on the bill. So we are now open for public testimony on House Bill 349. Ms. Riker, is there anyone online?
No.
And we've got a couple people in the room, but nobody is seeking to give testimony. So I'm going to shut public testimony on House Bill 349. Excuse me. That was a little harsh. Any other questions from the committee? All right. Well, then it will be my intention to put this bill aside to give you a notification of an amendment deadline for Monday, April 18th at 4 p.m. Representative Shragi will be chairing next week, so his office would be the most direct, but either myself or co-chair Shragi's office by 4 p.m. Monday if there were amendments, and we should see this bill again after that. All right. Thank you, Mr. McKee. And thank you, AOGCC and DNR and law for all being here. We needed a significant amount of edification for something that is probably not as complicated as our understanding of it was. And then we are going to take up House Bill 411. We'll just take a brief at ease and shuffle the chairs. We're coming back to order. Next up, we'll have House Bill 411 relating to municipal tax exemptions and deferrals on economic development property. Mr. Johnston, would you join us for any opening remarks, please?
For the record, Ryan Johnston, staff to Representative Shragi. No opening remarks, Madam Co-Chair, but I would say that we have some invited testimony that will shed a little bit more light on the issue from a hands-on perspective. Mike Edgerton from the Girdwood Supervisors Board is on to provide invited testimony, and I think he'd be the best place to start.
Okay. Mr. Edgerton, if you would introduce yourself, put your name and any affiliation on the record, and go ahead and give us your testimony.
Thank you. First of all, I'd like to thank Co-Chairs Hannon and Shragi for listening to me today. My name is Mike Edgerton. I'm a resident of Girdwood and also co-chair of Girdwood Board of Supervisors. While the board has discussed this, we haven't made an official decision, so I'm speaking effectively on behalf of myself, but in light of the experience I have on the Girdwood Board of Supervisors. I'll briefly summarize the issue and then go into a little bit more background. So the purpose of HB 411, I think, is to address what I believe is an unintended limitation to economic development tax incentives that are available to some communities in Alaska. As currently written, the statute prevents some communities making full use of these tax incentives. So now I'll just say a little bit about the situation in Girdwood and why it affects us. So although Girdwood is a physically and culturally separate community, for local government purposes, it's within the unified municipality of Anchorage. But since we are a separate community, both physically separate and probably culturally separate, we have different local conditions, different needs, different concerns, and different services we need. So the way we address those differences is by having our own service area. And in fact, Girdwood has a very extensive set of services under that service area. We run our own police, our own fire, our own roads and drainage services, and our own parks and rec services. And the consequence of this is about 40% of the taxes levied in Girdwood, are for these local services. The rest is basically school districts. We pay approximately 60% of our tax levies for the school district and 40% for local services under the service board service area. Back in 2007, the legislature expanded the ability of municipalities to provide tax incentives for local economic development, but for reasons I don't completely understand, excluded the taxes paid for under the service areas themselves, if that service area was run by an elected board, which is the situation here. So we end up in a situation where the statute doesn't allow us to provide a tax incentive for taxes levied against for the minimum school contributions, and it doesn't allow us to provide any exemptions or incentives against taxes for service areas. So in the case of Girdwood, that effectively prevents us from making use of this of these incentives at all. And we do have a number of different economic issues in our community. We are, as is the whole of the state, we're affected by high cost and low availability of housing. But in addition to the rest of the state, we also have a number of impacts from being a tourist resort. Resorts across the whole of the West, really the whole of the country, have been hit by a very high demand and low availability of housing. And we would like to be able to provide some tax incentives to encourage more affordable housing, more attainable housing within our community. And we're prevented from doing that by effect what I think is really quite a technical issue in the statute. So what we're really asking is for a relatively small targeted change, which will allow service area taxes to be exempted under certain conditions if both the municipality and the service area agree. And that's the change in front of it. I think in terms of the so my focus is really on the impact of that in my community, but I've looked at a number of other boroughs across the state, and there are many other communities which are in a similar position. So it wouldn't be just for us, but I think it would be a widespread benefit to communities across the state. I'm happy to take any questions.
Mr. Representative McCarty and then Representative Prox.
Thank you. Through the chair, I have a couple of questions. Girdwood is part of the borough or muni of Anchorage. So there's the assembly or the muni has given Girdwood some latitude of doing this service area of contracts with Whittier PD and doing other type of things. So if there was a consideration, and I don't understand this, you may could explain this, but does the assembly, based on home rule dynamics that Girdwood is part of, does the assembly have to sign off on any type of taxation that occurs currently for Girdwood?
I'm not a lawyer, but my understanding is that all of our how it works in terms of tax levies, we're in this process now, is the Girdwood Board of Supervisors proposes a tax level. It's officially ratified by the Assembly. I believe the Assembly does have the power to change that, but I don't think it's ever been done that way, and I doubt it would be in the future. Generally, it's we are giving a recommendation for a tax level, and that is then applied by the Assembly, but it does require at least the confirmation by Assembly.
Follow up. So what I'm hearing you say is that the Girdwood is still under the umbrella of the Muni of Anchorage, and
right,
because of home rule, recognizing that the state, in the case of Girdwood, really doesn't have a say in this issue. It's up to the borough or the Muni of Anchorage that has that. Otherwise, Girdwood to go to the Boundary Commission and ask for seceding from the Muni to become its own entity to be able to consider taxation on its own.
I would say yes and no. The way I would disagree with that statement is that the municipality is still bound by state statute. And the municipality effectively has taken the language of the state statute and applied this restriction to say that tax exemptions cannot be used against any service area tax levies, because that's what the state law says. And that effectively ties the municipality's hands as well. So the municipality can't apply, even though they have effectively the overriding authority here. The Assembly can't apply tax incentives against service area board levies because the state law says they can't. So the Assembly can't do it by themselves because the Assembly doesn't have the power under state law to change to provide tax incentives under service area boards. And obviously the service area board can't do it by themselves because we require the Assembly to agree. So we're stuck in this kind of catch-22 situation where there is no way around it because the state statute says that there is incentives cannot be applied against service area boards where there's an active board.
Follow up just in that piece there, and I believe that the state sets the minimum standards, but if the this applies to any type of home rule, that they go up top of that, those standards, to what applies to their area of jurisdiction. So I concerned that an area would come to the state and say we have to do these things because we don't like what our local home rule is deciding, that sends us down a dangerous path.
I agree with you. That would set us down a dangerous path. That isn't the situation here. What I think what we're talking about is in a situation where a service board wants to apply a tax incentive. The Assembly wants to apply the tax incentive, but the statute says that it cannot be done. Now, again, I'm not a lawyer. I'm sure there are people who have a better understanding of the nuances of these rules, but that's the situation we're kind of stuck in at the moment. If there is, whatever the wills of both the Assembly and the service area are, we cannot apply any incentives because of the state statute.
And Rep. McCarty, I'll just say that we do have a lawyer online to testify in relation to the bill, and not Ledge Legal, but Mr. Falls, William Falsey, who is senior counsel at Birch Horton, but we'll finish up our questions here before we turn to him. Representative Prox, you are next. Co-Chair Schrage.
Thank you, Co-Chair Hannon. I think just to make sure I've got this straight, the service area, Girdwood in this case, is looking for the ability to exempt a property from service area taxation, and at this point could not do that if they wanted to. Is that
correct?
Okay. This wouldn't, I gotta state the obvious, I guess, in question. This wouldn't affect, if Girdwood wanted to provide a tax exemption for the service area taxation, they still wouldn't have, or they would still have to go through the Assembly if they also wanted to provide an exemption from general taxation.
We would not have the power to provide an exemption for under general taxation. And as I said, the limitations under the current statute are that exemptions cannot be applied to, I believe, the minimum contribution for school districts,
right,
or any service area levies. So I think the Assembly at the moment could provide a tax exemption for any for the difference between the minimum and the existent tax contribution to school districts, but not for the service area component at all. So we would not. Technically, we don't have the power to unilaterally decide this. We have to at least have it ratified by the Assembly.
Yep.
But we would be looking to potentially. We do not have any very specific project in mind at the moment. We're just looking in as a general set of tools to help us primarily with housing in the community, but potentially with other areas of economic development as well. But just we ran into this sort of roadblock of just not having the ability either at the service area board or at the assembly level to provide these incentives. What is effectively a large component of the local taxes.
Mm-hmm. Follow up.
So let's see. Let's in the example that the service area wanted to grant the tax exemption. The Assembly would still maintain sort of a veto over that if the Assembly.
Yes, that's correct.
Yes.
That's my understanding. Again, there may be a more nuanced view from an attorney, but that's my understanding as a non-attorney.
Okay, thank you.
Co-Chair Hannon, could I just have a clarifying remark?
Please, Co-Chair Shragi.
So, yeah, if they wanted to provide that tax exemption, that has to originate with the municipality. The Special Service Area Board does not have the ability to provide that exemption. They want to be able to consider that as an option, but that has to come from the municipality. However, statute currently prohibits the municipality from applying an exemption to Special Service Area property taxes as a result of the statute. So the municipality is just prohibited.
Okay. Representative Drummond.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you, Mr. Edgington, for calling in today. So because you don't currently have a particular project in the pipeline for a potential tax exemption or deferral, should one come up, Girdwood and the Municipal Assembly still have to agree to do it. And the Assembly has the ultimate say-so in whether it happens or not. Is that correct?
That's my understanding, yes.
And that should this bill pass? Of course, that's assuming this bill passes.
Yes, at the moment.
Okay.
Yes, at the moment, if this bill does not pass, we do not have the option at all.
Okay. Thank you. Thank you, Madam Chair.
All right. I am not seeing any more hands. Mr. Edgington, thank you so much for taking your – are you trying – actually, I was about to say we didn't.
Thank you very much for the opportunity.
Actually, we've got one more question for you, Representative McCartney.
Actually, a question for this presenter or the attorney or such. So is this prohibiting any municipality or any home rule from doing any exemptions at all?
That's not the case if services are provided by something other than a service area board, an elected service area board. So, for example, if we take Anchorage, which I understand better, there are services, the police service is done under a service area, but it's not an elected board. So the municipality could provide tax exemptions for the component of taxes which go towards the fire service or police service in other parts of Anchorage, where there is no elected board running those services. It's the limitation is on elected boards. So effectively, we are penalized by having sort of local democratic control over these services. If there was no elected board at all, then there could be tax exemptions applied.
Mm-hmm. All right. That question, I bet we might hear that question again to the next presenter. But seeing no one else, we're going to go on. And Mr. William Falsey, if you'll put your name and your affiliation on the record and give us your testimony.
Well, thank you. My name is Bill Falsey. I am an attorney in private practice. I'm testifying today in my personal capacity. I will apologize. I caught only the second half of Mr. Edgington's testimony, so some of this may be a little bit redundant. But I want to thank the committee for its consideration of House Bill 411. I support the measure, which would correct an issue that was created in 2017 by then Senate Bill 100 that does create significant challenges for municipalities that want to enact economic development tax incentive in areas where taxes are mostly collected for a service area that is supervised by a board. And so by way of background, in 2017, Senate Bill 100 expanded the ability of municipalities to provide for economic development tax incentives. It was a good bill, and it's been put to good effect, and it's going to continue to pay dividends for communities all across the state. But it also added a new limitation to Alaska Statute 294550M that today reads as follows. A municipality may not apply an exemption or deferral under this subsection to taxes levied for special services in a service area that is supervised by a board under Alaska Statute 2935460. And by way of reminder, service areas are a concept authorized by Article 10, Section 5 of the Alaska Constitution. They are effectively taxing districts within boroughs and unified municipalities that offer local services that a borough or unified municipality doesn't provide on an area-wide basis. And they're very common. In the Unified Municipality of Anchorage, for example, most core services are provided through service areas. Police through the Anchorage Metropolitan Police Service Area, fire through the fire service area, Parks and Recreation to the Anchorage Parks and Recreation Service Area, and most main road service through ARTSA, the Anchorage Roads and Drainage Service Area. And that wasn't a big issue at all when it came to 120, of Senate Bill 100, rather, because those service areas, those big service areas, aren't supervised by a board. Police isn't, fire isn't, Parks and Recreation isn't, ARTSA isn't. But there are board-supervised service areas in the municipality. There are numerous limited road service areas. They're mostly located on the hillside or out of the Anchorage Bowl. Parks and fire boards in Chugiak and Eagle River, and most significantly, as you were discussing earlier, the Girdwood Valley Service Area, which almost operates like a small city. It provides separate police, fire, roads, and parks services to the Girdwood community. In 2017, the new exclusion for service areas supervised by a board was added late in the SB 100 process. And the concern, which seems to have surfaced in a March 28, 2017 committee hearing, seemed to be that a borough or a municipal assembly might enact an economic development incentive that would negatively affect a board-supervised service area. But the SB 100 fix shouldn't have been to ban economic development incentives in board-supervised service areas altogether. It should have been to let the service area have a say and decide for themselves. And so House Bill 411 would make that surgical correction. It would again go to the pre-SB 100 situation and allow tax incentives in board-supervised service areas where the service area board doesn't object. And that is particularly meaningful in a place like Girdwood. After Senate Bill 100, economic development property tax incentives are mostly just off the table, and that's because the state statute doesn't apply to a portion of school taxes. It doesn't apply to these board-supervised service area taxes. And in Girdwood, taxes are mostly just area-wide school taxes and Girdwood Valley service area taxes. Mechanically, the fix proposed in HB 411 allows service areas to opt out by passing a resolution of objection no later than 30 days after the local ordinance affecting putting in the tax exemption into effect passes. And of course, that 30-day window would come after all of the notice and public hearing requirements that applied to the underlying ordinance passed by the borough or municipal assembly itself. So there wouldn't be any surprises. There'd be ample opportunity for the service area board to meet, deliberate, and act. And I'll say this issue was sort of a known issue in the last few years, but it is sort of percolating more to the surface. You may have seen local coverage in Anchorage, where the Bronson administration and the assembly have been deliberating on an economic development tax incentive proposal that would aim to incentivize the creation of more accessory dwelling units, sort of mother-in-law apartments, additional housing. And if that comes to fruition, which I think all sides expect that it may, it just really wouldn't have an effect in Girdwood, which may be the area of the municipality that is most acutely in need of additional housing incentives. I'm happy to answer questions, but in sum, HB 411 is a good measure that, again, will allow all parts of the state to participate equally in the opportunities that were created by Senate Bill 100. I strongly support it, and I certainly appreciate the committee's consideration of the measure.
All right. Thank you, Mr. Falsey. So I'm looking to see if there are any questions. The historical context was very helpful. Co-Chair Shragi.
Yes, thank you, Co-Chair Hannon. Good to hear from you, Mr. Falsey. At the last committee hearing, there was discussion about the amount of notice required, and I appreciate you shedding some light on the current process and notice requirements that already exist. All that notwithstanding, would it be an issue if it was 60 days notice, or do you have any thoughts on some of the changes that were proposed at the last committee hearing?
Thank you, through co-chair to co-chair, Shragi. I appreciate that question. Yes, and this somewhat sheds light on some of the conversation that was happening before. Under the Alaska statutes and Alaska Constitution, only the borough and municipal assemblies can set the mill rates and levy taxes. So in a place like Girdwood, they propose a budget and the assembly implements it. So there's the control is still on the taxing side. It's still going to be with the assembly. And likewise, under Alaska Statute Title 29, only the assembly can pass ordinances and only the assembly could cause into effect an economic development tax incentive proposal. So the way this would actually play out is that the assembly or the mayor would introduce a proposed ordinance in the regular course in Anchorage. That's going to get you at least a 2-week notice and a public hearing and then assembly deliberation and action. And if and only if the ordinance that implements the economic development tax incentive is passed and not vetoed and or vetoed and override, then the 30-day window would open. So I think that would be ample opportunity for all of our service area boards to watch an ordinance move through the process, see it be passed or not, then notice a meeting, deliberate, and act. But I don't think there's any particular reason to oppose 60 days as opposed to 30 days. I think both are reasonable windows, and it certainly comes down to more practical concerns rather than first-order policy concerns.
Thank you. That's very helpful.
Representative McCarty, then Representative Drummond.
Okay. Thank you, through the chair. Thanks for being here. As looking at this and making consideration for exemptions, are there, and I'm thinking of industrial type of exemptions for taxation to incentivize businesses, are there any recommendation that you have that exemptions should not exist for taxation? Any thoughts to that?
Yes, through the co-chair to Representative McCarty. I'll say sort of generally, I served in the municipality of Anchorage, both as the city attorney and later as the municipal manager. And I find myself very philosophically aligned with the Alaska Municipal, what I understand to be the Alaska Municipal League position, which is generally allowing for more local control. I think the local assemblies are closest to their communities. They know what works and what doesn't. The state of play now is that even as the home rule municipalities, there is a suite of state law provisions that limit the power of home rule municipalities. And the rules about property taxation are very locked down. They're very controlled by Alaska Statute 29, I think it's Chapter 45. So right now you'll find the required exemptions and the optional exemptions. So to your question, what are there things that I think state law should, what I understood the question to be, are there things that state law should preclude localities from doing on the taxation and exemption side? I think philosophically, I generally am more in the camp of trusting the local elected officials. If there were no limitations on how the localities could provide tax incentives, I think it would still work out appropriately through the local public processes. And so I'm not sure I can recommend a limitation that I think would be necessary. I think generally I am in favor of fewer limitations.
Okay, thank you.
All right, Representative Drummond.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Good to hear you, Bill. Appreciate you being with us today. So because of the kinds of services that the Girdwood Valley service area provides, the other service areas in the municipality of Anchorage, including the Eagle River and Chugiak Road service areas and park service areas, would not be impacted by this type of exemption that House Bill 411 proposes to allow. It's because Girdwood provides a lot more services than those other, I guess we'd call it, they're called for a reason, limited road service areas, for example, on the hillside. Because I don't hear Eagle River or Chugiak asking for these exemptions because they can probably already get them. Is that true?
To the chair, to Representative Drummond, that's mostly true, mostly in a matter of degree rather than in kind, by which I mean if you were to look at a tax bill for Girdwood, you'd see maybe 13 mills of taxes, of which 7 of them would be school district taxes that everyone is paying, and the rest would be Girdwood Valley service area taxes. And so that remainder, those 6 mills, are just off the table as a result of this SB 100 problem. In Eagle River, Chugiak, you may have a little bit of the same issue, but mostly the SB 100 didn't create problems, by which I mean there are portions of Eagle River Chugiak Birchwood that have board supervised parks and recreation service areas and some road service areas, but the effect is much smaller. So most of the tax bill would still be police dollars. There are portions of Eagle River that are part of the Anchorage Fire Service Area, which could be abated as part of a tax incentive program. So under the current law, tax incentives are less off the table in most portions of the municipality than they are in Girdwood. But it does have some effect in the northern communities and certainly a little bit of effect on the hillside. As a practical matter, on the hillside, the limited road service areas that have elected board supervisors may be paying more like 1 or 2 mills for road service, so that all of the tax bill would still potentially be abatable except for that last mill, although that would change under this proposal, HB 411.
Okay, great. Thank you.
I am not seeing anyone trying to get my attention to ask you any questions, so thank you, Mr. Falsey. Thank you, Mr. Edgington. We do also have online Robert Peason from the Division of Community and Regional Affairs. Mr. Peason, did you have specific testimony or anything that you think we're muddying up that you could help clarify and get us to understand?
I was just here for any questions, and so far no issues have come up that are related to DCRA's role.
Okay. All right. Then I am going to switch gears and open public testimony. Oh, no, Representative Fox, go ahead.
Present.
Okay. So we are opening public testimony on House Bill 411. Ms. Riker, is there... There is no one online. There is no one in the room besides us. So I'm going to close public testimony. Representative Prox.
Oh, thank you, Co-Chair Hannon. If we wanted to, we haven't heard officially yet, I don't think, from the Fairbanks North Star Borough, nor the Kenai Borough, and I guess for that matter, the Juneau Borough. And they all work just a little bit differently. So the question is, if I wanted to ask the Fairbanks North Star Borough to specifically testify, can we still do that?
Certainly.
Okay. I'll make that call. Thank you.
We can make that happen again. All right. Mr. Johnson, did you have any summation statements or... Co-Chair Shragi?
No, ma'am. For the record, Ryan Johnston, Staff Representative Shragi. No, ma'am. I think Mr. Falsey hit the point about the 30-day window for those service area boards. So as the municipality might have a veto, the service area boards also still retain the ability to opt out, and we think that addresses the issue of the 2017 concerns.
It is my intention, and I'm going to set an amendment deadline on Monday, but it would be our intention to hear the bill again on Tuesday. If we have additional invited or public testimony that gives us indication of additional amendments, we can certainly extend an amendment deadline. Since it's in the script and it's been part of the plan, we'll say that we are... Right now, for members looking for any amendments to the co-chair's offices by 4 p.m. on Monday the 18th. But we also have heard here on the record that we would like to hear from a couple other municipalities. And as I was thinking about it, I think Juneau, we are a unified first-class borough, and I don't think any of our limited service areas have elected boards. So I think... and, of course, as soon as I say that, I go, oh, I should ask my senator who served on our assembly for more than a dozen years to confirm that. But I think all of our limited service areas are just appointed boards, not elected boards, so we're not in the same catch-22. All right. Well, then we are let me take a brief at ease. Thank you all for being with us this morning, Mr. Pearson, Mr. Edgerton, Mr. Falsey. And we will take this bill back up on Tuesday the 19th. Brief at ease. We're back, and we're going to take up House Bill 402, relating to identification requirements for contractors and home inspectors. Mr. Johnston from Representative Shragi's office is carrying the bill for the committee. Mr. Johnston, is there anything you would like to add before we proceed to open testimony?
Thank you, Madam Co-Chair. Ryan Johnston, staff to Representative Shragi. Just to provide a little bit of some context for today. So for invited testimony, we had reached out to the Associated General Contractors of Alaska to potentially provide invited testimony, but they're currently involved in their statewide conference in Fairbanks right now, so they weren't able to be in the room today or online. I will say that the Associated General Contractors had provided a letter of support for the Senate companion version and wrote a letter requesting that this bill be introduced. So I can work with the Alaska General Contractors to get a letter of support specifically for this bill, but I just wanted to let the committee know that there has been a letter of support for the companion version, and they weren't able to be here today.
Okay. We do have online Ms. Hoskinson, Director of the Division of Corporations, Business, and Professional Licensing. And I'm not seeing anyone specifically, and I know you're there to provide answers to questions versus a public statement, but so I'll try and give you one, which is, does the division have any concerns or thoughts on this change in the requirement that would allow for direction of for contractors to be directed to a website as opposed to having to require all their license numbers on advertisements? Could you share your
good
thoughts?
Morning.
Thank you.
Absolutely, Madam Chair. Good morning. This is Glenn Hoskinson, Deputy Director with the Division of Corporations, Business, and Professional Licensing. To the Chair, no, the division does not have any concerns with this. This seems like, you know, kind of a modernization that makes a lot of sense.
Do you have off the top of your head a ballpark number of the number of businesses and licenses that this would impact that currently have to list all their digits when they are advertising?
To the Chair, give me just one moment here. I can tell you that we have about 6,270 active licensed contractors in Alaska.
Okay. Here we go. Members of the committee? No one is seeking your expert guidance this morning, Ms. Hoskinson. But thank you. Oh, good. That provoked a question.
Thanks.
Representative McCarty.
Through the Chair, since it was brought up, is there any difference between the House Bill 402, and I do not have the Senate version, but since the industry isn't able to respond, but they did respond to the Senate version, is there any difference between the two at all?
Mr. Johnston.
Ryan Johnston. Representative McCarty, it is a matching bill. We took the Senate version and just stuck the House number on it and worked it away. So it's a exact match.
Okay. All right, then I am going to open public testimony on House Bill 402. So I'm opening public testimony on 402, and we have no one signed up to testify online, and we have no one in the room seeking to testify on House Bill 402. So we're going to close public testimony with a gavel. And once again, we're going to – oh. Actually, I should say, members of the committee, anything that you would like to say? All right. Then the intention is to set House Bill 402 aside and be taken up next week. We will have amendments for this due on Wednesday, April 20th, and have it scheduled to be back before the committee on Thursday, April 21st next week. So Wednesday, the 20th by 4 p.m. for amendments on House Bill 402. With that, we have concluded today's calendared and scheduled business for today. Our next meeting is Tuesday the 19th at 8 a.m., and we will adjourn this meeting of the House Community and Regional Affairs Committee at 9:32 a.m. Thank you all.